Okay, thank you for that introduction. When you look back on paper, it all sounds very good. thank you to Dr. Ashok and the other conference organizers for putting all this together, especially given that this is rather a new topic for me. Most of what I do is cognitive neurophysiology. And as a historical matter, most of what I have done is cognitive neurophysiology within UK and US populations. So I have not been particularly diverse about my work, and I am coming to the field of cross-cultural psychology as very much a neophyte, but perhaps that allows me to voice naive observations that other people might not have the foolishness to voice. So I want to talk to you about culture and cognition, was the topic given to me. And I would like to approach that topic from the direction in which I myself got into it. That is, from clinical and typical cognitive variations. I have studied both autism and variation of autistic traits in typical individuals. And my approach to cognition across cultures stems from that study. Just to illustrate that a human being is far from entirely encoded in the genes, there is a huge role for environment and experience. This was a study we did about 5 years ago now. We studied two monozygotic twins. One of them was severely autistic, and the other did not meet diagnostic criteria, and the dependence was really entirely environmental. So environment and experience are a big part of things. What are the experiential effects on brain and cognition? You have a pattern of genes, and those interact with environment. Where do those environmental influences come from? Well, there are clinical conditions and individual variations. That is one aspect of variation. There are also the influences of short-term situational variables. You put someone in one particular experimental or behavioral context. You put me in this context giving a talk this morning. I'm probably having a much greater state anxiety than I'm going to have tomorrow morning, right? And then also there are long-term variables of cultural experience. What is the environment within which an individual has developed and matured? Perhaps the most interesting question is the interaction between all of these three domains. For example, how does the manifestation and the outcome of the identical biologically based clinical condition differ in different cultural contexts or given different situational variables? And that's something I would like to explore. In order to explore this, I want to bring together three separate threads of research, and only one of them is explicitly about cross-cultural psychology. But as I hope to show you, I think all three of them actually become relevant and start to be talking about the same thing. And what I'd like to discuss is what, perhaps for lack of a better term, I can say is an iconic versus symbolic axis of human cognitive variation, which encompasses clinical psychological research, social psychological research, and cross-cultural psychological research. So again, historically, the way that I myself got into this field was from the study of autism. And one of the classic descriptions of autism, I won't, for lack of time, I won't dwell on the diagnostic criteria here, but many of you are familiar with autism. One of the classic descriptions of autism is Jutta Frith and Francesca Happe's notion of weak central coherence. Well, what do we mean by central coherence? They defined it as the ability to bind together separate details and separate elements of perception into a high-level, abstract, complex perception. So, for example, if I'm standing here in this auditorium, I'm going to remember it as an auditorium. I won't necessarily remember how many rows of seats there were, or how many fans there were on the side, or any of these, how many windows there were, etc., any of these minor details, because I tend to bind together those details into the single percept of auditorium, and then mask out and forget the individual perceptual sources. So I have a certain bias towards bringing individual percepts together into a complete context, rather than dwelling on all the individual details. People with autism do not have that bias. They have the opposite bias. And they're the ones who might neglect to notice that the room is in fact an auditorium, because they would be dwelling on every individual particular detail of the room. Okay, well, that's autism. Second thread I would like to bring together is work exemplified by Yaakov Trappé's work in social psychology on what Trappé calls level of construal and what he calls psychological distance. Now, actually, what Trappé terms level of construal happens to be exactly what Frith and Happe talked about as central coherence. It's just that very often people studying the psychology of clinical conditions and people studying typical social psychology don't talk to each other. Okay, so we have two separate phrases, one central coherence, one level of construal, meaning exactly the same thing. The tendency to bind together details into wholes or gestalts. Trappé stated, and there are many experimental observations of his and others that I won't have time in 20 minutes to go into, but he stated that level of construal is actually related to psychological distance. Trappé defined psychological distance in at least four forms: spatial, temporal, hypothetical, and social. Well, what are these? Spatial distance is the tendency to refer or to perceive objects close up in an egocentric frame rather than far away or in an allocentric frame. Temporal distance, the tendency to dwell on happenings in the here and now rather than what happened a long time ago or what will happen far in the future. Hypothetical distance, the tendency to focus on what is definite, what will happen, what is happening, versus what is hypothetical, what might happen, what would take place if a certain other condition is fulfilled. And lastly, social distance, one aspect of which is, of course, theory of mind, the ability to take perspective and to relate to other individuals in the social context versus the tendency to dwell on one's own egocentric social perspective. So these four forms of psychological distance, as I've described them, actually all are affected in autism. And every one of them is the subject of one or more questions on the standard autism diagnostic inventory. There certainly is a relationship between level of construal and psychological distance. Trappé shows that with situational manipulations. For example, you can prime someone by having them write a story about what is happening to them today versus what might happen to them a year from now. And you can find that after those two different experiences of near and far psychological distance, people become primed for different levels of construal, different orientations towards detail or gist, as measured by something as simple as the Navon task, which we'll get to in a moment. Lastly, the third thread that I would like to draw into this is cross-cultural comparisons of perception and social cognition, as exemplified by the work of Richard Nisbet and others. I won't dwell on that because Nisbet actually uses many of the same manipulations cross-culturally that Trappé uses situationally. So here we have three separate sets of authors and three separate paradigms, all of which seem to be feeding in to this same axis of variation, one end of which is local detail orientation, egocentric social perspective, high individualism, the other end of which is contextual orientation, gestalt perception, binding separate details into abstractions, and orientation towards the allocentric social context and social perspective taking, rather than towards egocentrism. Okay, so here is an example of one measure of either central coherence, if you prefer that term, or a level of construal, if you prefer that term. So I'm going to flash, and a lot of you know this Navon task already, I'm going to flash a letter, or one or more letters, just for an instant, and you're going to tell me the letter that jumps out to you. You may experience more than one letter, just tell me the letter that you most strongly perceive. What was that? Okay, so a lot of people said S. For how many people was it S? Yeah, okay. For how many people was it N? Okay, so we have a little bit of variation. But the interesting thing is, if I were doing this talk and this experiment with an audience in London or New York, the result, the proportion of people in the audience who said one thing or another, would differ. And that is a manifestation of cultural variation in orientation to context versus orientation to detail. In London or New York, I would get more N's than I got here. Here I get more S's. And so this is one task that people like Trappé, people like Nisbet, and also autism researchers use to evaluate orientation towards detail or gist. I'm going to skip that in the interest of time. Let me talk about some of the physiological underpinnings of these typical and atypical cognitive variations. Now, we are all at some position on a fairly normal distribution of what is called social responsiveness or social communicative ability. And out here on the tail of very, very low social communicative ability, you start picking up the diagnoses of Asperger syndrome, autism, this kind of thing. But the point is, in individuals within any particular culture, this is a continuous curve. It's unimodal, and it's only as you go out onto the tail, out onto the extreme, that you start picking up the clinical diagnoses. Well, that raises an interesting question. If cultural practices can alter social competence and orientation towards the social context, then might actually the shape of this curve or the mean or median of this curve shift between different cultures? And the answer, extrapolating from the work of Nisbet, though nobody has tried this particular instrument as yet cross-culturally, seems to be yes. So then the question is, how does that affect the prevalence and the outcome of clinical diagnoses. Here again is a slide. This is three different groups, and this is a physiological response during an attention task. This is people without any autism spectrum condition, and this is people with autism, and this is people who are siblings. They have family members with autism, but they are not themselves autistic. And you can see that the peak response in this attention task is delayed in the people with autism and in their family members. I won't go into the details of the task just for lack of time. But the interesting bit for the current discussion is that when we take a measure of social communicative competency, when we administer a survey measure of social communicative competency, the latency at which this peak occurs, the time delay here to this peak, actually correlates with social communicative competency. And that is not just between the clinical and non-clinical groups. It actually is within all the groups. Even within the typical individuals, the peak timing was predicted slightly by social communicative competency. So we begin to see that there are physiological underpinnings to these social variables. And this particular physiological study has not yet been done cross-culturally, but I am predicting that we are going to find cross-cultural differences actually in brain physiology and in the timing of attentional response. Let's see, I'm going to skip this in the interest of time. No, I won't, actually. The basic difference in people who have a more allocentric or a more egocentric perceptual and social orientation, in people who have high or low levels of construal, seems to be the degree to which the brain operates either as a unified whole, in the case of allocentric perception, or as a collection of independent parts or independent sub-processors, in the case of egocentric perception. So the egocentric perceiver will have many individual brain areas, only one of which will be active at a certain time. The allocentric perceiver will bring a wide array of brain areas together and exchange information between those brain areas to unify a percept into a complete whole. What kind of perceptual style does the disconnected versus the highly connected brain lead to? Well, a disconnected brain develops a cognitive strategy that specializes in single details, single perceptual channels. It zeroes in on individual features. It is iconic rather than symbolic in its perceptual style. And it is egocentric in its social and perceptual perspectives rather than allocentric. So we have found that both in terms of cognition within typical individuals and in terms of comparisons between autistic and non-autistic cognition, this paradigm holds. What we are betting on is that a similar paradigm also will hold between more allocentrically and more egocentrically oriented cultures. There is a relationship between social and non-social aspects of this cognitive style. For example, working in North Americans, we have found that men with prolonged reaction times in a go-no-go task actually have lesser social perceptual and social communicative capacities, as measured by the reading the mind in the eyes test and the autism spectrum quotient. This relationship holds physiologically too. We find that people with a increased score on the reading the mind in the eyes test, which is a test of social cognition, have a decreased amplitude of the evoked potential P300 response in a go-no-go task. That's another thing that is waiting to be done across cultures. of course, autism is an extreme of individual, detail-oriented perception. And we all of us are somewhere on this axis between detail and just perception. But what I would like to point out is that behavioral context and cultural context is important in determining whether that detail-oriented perceptual style is adaptive or maladaptive. And in some perceptual and behavioral contexts, that detail orientation can be exactly what you want. So if this iconic symbolic axis, and I'll just take 2 minutes to finish up if I may, if this iconic symbolic axis is affected by clinical state, by situational manipulations, and by culture, then the question arises, might development within a more contextually focused culture serve as a partial antidote to autistic traits? Our conjecture is that there is going to be a nonlinear interaction between culture and severity of autistic traits, with opposite outcomes depending upon the initial degree. As efficient as a socially focused culture is at scaffolding and shaping appropriate behaviors in people who are mildly affected, in people who may not be overtly abnormal and thus overtly a member of the outgroup, that society is also extremely efficient at excluding and shunning people who are members of the outgroup and who are overtly abnormal. So we're doing work in Kolkata right now to look at the mild end of the autism spectrum, to look at Asperger syndrome and mild autistic traits, and to examine the question of whether the family and social experience may more efficiently scaffold and shape behavior in those individuals, leading to more adjusted outcomes. I'll skip that in the interest of time. So this leads to the question of how might culturally specific practices be adapted to therapy worldwide? What can worldwide therapies for clinical conditions and what can worldwide educational practices for typical individuals learn from culturally specific practices? And I'll skip the details on this, but we are at the moment studying a social communicative method that was developed here in India and actually has its roots here in Bangalore and has since been exported to the US and the UK. And I think in the interest of time, I'll stop there. I've only given you a brief overview, but the point I want to leave you with is that cultural variation, situational variation, and clinical variation all tap in to this axis of human cognitive diversity that goes from strong individualistic, egocentric, detail-oriented perception on the one end, and allocentric, gestalt perception on the other hand. And we have a lot to learn in studying that. Thank you very much.